The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What's up, guys and girls? I would like to welcome you to the Real Talk Week, a special week where I'm giving you a brand new Real Talk with Zuby episode every weekday. 5 new podcasts, 5 new guests, and 5 new awesome sponsors. While we're in this lockdown period, I thought it would be really important to help people to promote their businesses, their services, and their products. So make sure you check out the sponsor of each daily episode and tell them that Zuby sent you. Now, today's podcast is sponsored by a startup company called Regimen Performance. Now, they are creating a revolution in home fitness with an electronically controlled, high-intensity strength training machine that they call the Epoch. It works without using weights by matching the exact resistance that your body creates, allowing you to get stronger faster. This is all done with increased safety, while the machine automatically tracks your progress and the touchscreen interface allows you to train online with experts. What Peloton did for spin bikes, Regimen is doing for strength training. The team at Regimen would like to find and connect with enthusiastic supporters of what they're building. They're also seeking funding to continue creating this amazing machine, so if you want a chance of owning one, head over to their website and check them out. Search for Regimen Performance on Twitter or Instagram, or sign up to their newsletter at regimenepoch.com. That is Regimen, R-E-G-I-M-E-N, Epoch, E-P-O-C-H.com, regimenepoch.com. Get involved, ask questions, and share with others. Go check them out, regimenepoch.com. Now on with the show.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back once again for another episode of Real Talk with Zuby. On today's episode, we have got on a very well-known author and journalist, and this is Mike Cernovich. Welcome to the show, man.
How you doing? It's great to see you.
Likewise, bro. All good. So for people who may not know you, how do you describe yourself to the world?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question, right? That's always the hardest question because I do so much in a lot of different fields, but I keep it general. I've done everything from I wrote a best-selling book on mindset. I think that's actually how you and I initially connected was like 5 years ago, completely away from all of this. And then I went from having a pretty cool like 4-hour work week style, you know, life, traveling all over the world, writing books, hanging out, to ruining my life and getting involved in politics. And now I do sort of a hybrid mixture of some media reporting, media commentary, the break a big story when I can get it. Mm-hmm. Break a small story when I can get it, and just keep the faith and keep the pressure on.
Awesome. Well, I think what would be really interesting actually is to kind of hit rewind and go back into, you know, finding out a little bit more about you. I think a lot of people have heard about you and have sort of seen certain things and whatever, but you know, with most people who have had an interesting life, that's always just the tip of the iceberg. So it would be interesting to sort of find out a little bit more about your background and how you even got into these different areas, right? How you started, you know, like what's the story? What's the story behind all that?
Right. That's what's interesting when you're a public figure, public, whatever you want to call it. People will get a glimmer of the kaleidoscope and then that's how they define you. And I've seen it even done to you now because I've seen your stuff for years. Yeah. I'm like, that's not even true, right?
Yeah.
So there's always two reactions I have to people. One is, well, you know, I might not think that that's fair that you would think that, but I can see why you think that. Mm. And then other times, it's not even true. I don't even know where you people are getting this from.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to really become used to it. But I got into, so I started off, I was a lawyer, went to law school, moved out to California from a small town, went to law school, was doing lawyer stuff. But all my life early on, I'd done like martial arts and read philosophy and was really just trying to kind of figure out life. Mm. You know, maybe I was a sad kid in hindsight. You know, it's hard to know for sure. Well, no, I mean, I certainly was as a little kid, a little sad kid probably. And was just always trying to figure out life just for myself. And then I remember when I was taking a road trip when I was 19 or so, 18, 19, 20, and I found this book, Dale Carnegie. It wasn't How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is great, but mm-hmm. it's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living.
Okay.
And it's actually the better of the two books. And I thought, man, you know, one day I want to kind of write a legacy book like this, a kind of book, you're dead for 100 years, some teenager is in a bookstore somewhere, and they find your book. Mm-hmm. And that was always in the back of my mind that I wanted to do it. I just wasn't really sure how I would do it, what I would write about. But that was always in the back of my mind. So then I was in law school, was doing legal blogging. Mm-hmm. And I was an early adopter to like blogging as a platform to, because I never wanted to be a writer. This is what's weird about these paths that people take is I never wanted to be a writer per se, but I always wanted to people to read me, which is sounds like a contradiction, but here yeah. we are. And I started law blogging, and then I transferred over to more lifestyle kind of blogging, more mindset kind of blogging, picked up a huge audience for that. Kind of, I was recognized in public for the first time from a blog, which is sort of, was kind of a weird thing, right?
Yeah. What were those first blogs? So I know you had.
Yeah, I had an early blog, Crime and Federalism.
Okay.
Yeah, that was just my early law blog. A lot of people don't know about that because I have a whole law life before my mindset life, before my whatever, socio-political commentary life. Yeah. And yeah, so people started recognizing me in public from the blog, and it was kind of weird. And then some of the articles were just like killing it on page views. So I reverse engineered how I'd write my book. I would see, oh, this article or whatever got 150,000 uniques or something and mm-hmm. 300,000 uniques. I'm like, wow, this is a lot. At least yeah. it felt like a lot, and I think it was a lot. Mm-hmm. And then, so then I started shaping my book around stuff that I had written. And then that gave way to Guerrilla Mindset, which I published in 2015 in Thailand.
Okay.
So I lived, I lived in, so that's just a kind of a, that's a shorter story, the longer story. Mm-hmm. But the meta story is that how your life vision becomes realized. I just always had this life vision that, you know what, one day I'm going to live in Paris and write in Paris. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how I was going to do that, but I knew it in my heart that I was going to do that. And then, you know, I did that.
Yeah.
And one day I'm going to write a book that like a lot of people read. And, you know, I've done that. Mm-hmm. And I never had, you know, way more people read me now, but I never could have even imagined now, but just it's incomprehensible most days.
So when you were writing the blog, what was the real motivation for that? Especially as someone who said you don't, you know, didn't and maybe still don't particularly love the art of writing. What was it that made you sort of keep going with that? Because I think blogs are pretty difficult to be consistent with. Like if you don't really, really just sort of like love the, I don't know, love the art of it itself. So what sort of kept you motivated in terms of just putting down those words and then just leaving them up on the internet for anyone to read?
Right. I would always just blow off steam. I've said it before that you shouldn't, whenever people go, oh, I want to start a podcast, I want to start a blog. And I go, well, can you not write? Mm. What do you mean? Do you feel like if you don't say something that you're going to throw up and feel sick?
Yeah.
I don't feel like you can do it because you won't make any money. If you do make money, it'll be a long time mm-hmm. away. You'll be in obscurity. Nobody's going to read your stuff. Just the nature of the world. But if you feel like it, so for me, I was just blowing off steam. I was just goofing off. Saying things, you know, and this just to show that I had no idea I'd be here. I would just say anything because I'm like, You know, just like, you know, firing stuff off, because that was the point. It was just like a goof off kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And then as you do that, you find your own voice. Mm-hmm. You know, the number one challenge that people have as an artist is, how do you find your voice? Well, you have to scream a lot.
Yeah.
You don't just get up there. I mean, some people maybe do, like Kanye or someone, right? But I'm not Kanye.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I'm the Kanye of Twitter now, but it took me 20 years to do that.
Yeah.
But I think about it, Notorious B.I.G., like, he and Tupac, they died in their like early 20s.
Yeah, mid 20s. Right?
And you're thinking, wait, so Tupac was doing that at 19?
That's crazy.
Yeah. So some people have that. Other people, you just got to grind for it. Mm. And I was definitely the latter category of person who I just had to grind.
Awesome. And you've gone through, I mean, with your blogs and your work, I mean, you've really gone through a big range of different things. So you started out in law, and then you moved on more to kind of masculinity and lifestyle kind of stuff, and then more into mindset and self-improvement, and then into the world of, you know, politics and commentary and journalism. What was the thread between all those different things?
The thread really is just crushing it, smashing it. Whatever you're going to do, just crush it. Mm. When I waited tables for tips for college, like, I just crushed it. I was like, I'm just going to be a great waiter. I'm just going to get the most tips, even though women always get tipped more than men, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But every time, like, even if it was some like crappy job, I was always like, just got to crush it. Mm. So the common thread was always just really bring it in whatever you do, and then level up at what you're doing, level up the leverage of what you're doing, level up the game of what you're doing. So that was the common thread. So that's why for me, it was nothing to go from, you know, I want to go to law school and I want to be like a legal scholar. Mm-hmm. And I want to like write articles that are influential. And I did. And then I want to write a website about gym stuff, mindset, lifestyle, just that nobody was, the stuff that people take for granted. Like me, I was talking about, you know, androgenics and a lot of other things that, you know, kids shouldn't get into. Mm-hmm. You know, something when you're much older, maybe you think about, nobody would talk openly about it. I would just say, look, here's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I was so fully transparent. Any part of my life, that sort of authenticity, especially from male writers, usually the authentic style was reserved. There were a lot of like female writers were kind of allowed to do that, but men weren't really allowed to do that. Just really authentic, vulnerable writing.
Yeah.
And I did that because if you want to be a writer, then, and you want to be a beautiful writer, you want to create anything beautiful and meaningful, you have to hurt. You have mm-hmm. to suffer. People mm-hmm. don't realize that. You have to share a piece of your soul every time you write. And that was a common theme. And because of that, like when I wrote about the kind of stuff I wrote about, there was no one else like doing it.
Yeah.
When I moved into Twitter or social media or whatever, mm-hmm. people just like, they'd never seen anything like that before. And that's because I bring in, you know, everything to it, my whole dimension, my whole character, my whole personality.
Yeah.
People are doing that a little bit more, but not really. Even not like if you follow like a conservative Twitter account, the conservative Twitter account is going to be like, you know, Trump's pretty good, but today I'm kind of mad, and mm-hmm. we need our guns, and you know, we love God and everything, mm-hmm. which is fine. If you follow a liberal account, Orange Man's bad and everything, right? But you just never hear somebody say, you know, I thought about killing myself last night, right? If you did, it would, like, the internet would stop.
Yeah,
but. But everybody,
or if they are saying it, they're saying it every day, and
right.
That is their actual theme.
Yeah, people they live that like one dimensional life of, well, yeah. I'm a political commentator, so I'm not going to talk about going to the gym, or I'm not going to talk about like a personal struggle I had, or I'm not going to talk about anything else. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to be more than one dimensional. I wanted to be three dimensional.
Yeah, no, I relate to that a lot, because for the first, you know, 10 years of my music career, I mean, I've been on social media a long time. I've been on Twitter since 2009, Facebook since 2004. Like, I've been on these platforms for a long time. And for the first 10 years, I made a sort of concerted decision not to talk about certain things, right? I was like, okay, I'm a musician. I'm an artist. I'm going to just use all this stuff for my art and for my music. And I'm not going to put anything political on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever. I'm not going to share my view on society or on culture, nothing beyond, my music really, and maybe the occasional little life update or travel update or something like this. And then, you know, for multiple reasons, I shifted in 2018 and just started, you know, rolling back, just bringing out more of my personality, right? Like lowering that shield a little bit. Sometimes I still question whether or not, you know, this was a good idea, but yeah, it's weird because you were talking about honesty and vulnerability and stuff like that. And that it's very much a double-edged sword because it makes people connect with you and really resonate with you. And people are like, yeah, this guy is saying what I'm thinking. But then at the same time, of course, it opens you up to a lot of attack or, you know, people digging up things from the past and using those to club you with, or there's so much more for people to misinterpret as well, you know. And I see that happen to you. You see that happen to me. Like you'll say one thing and then it goes through this weird Chinese whispers filter. And then it comes out on the other end, like you said, oh, wait, that's not what I said. It's certainly not what I meant. I guess, how do you sort of balance that? And what's been your experience with just kind of dealing with all the fallout? Because we live in a new time. I mean, in the past, I feel like someone could have done this. If you had an author who writes novels or writes books or whatever, they could have done that, but they weren't exposed to the feedback really, right? They put the novel out there and maybe they'd see the sales and get some money, but you don't take something out of your pocket or go on a computer and see like every single person under the sun telling you in detail what they think about you and their feedback and everything like that. So how do you manage it?
Well, now it's just part of the day job.
Yeah.
And I've lived through it all before. I'm like, oh God, I'm going to go here and do that.
Yeah.
But early on, no, it's bracing or is first of all, it's very human to want to be liked.
Yeah.
So when you find out people don't like you with an intensity that you can't comprehend, you're like, what did I do wrong? Right. You almost get gaslit into thinking you're at fault.
Yeah.
And then the worst is when you read articles that just aren't true.
Yes.
And that are like, one of them was I made the okay sign and it was the number one story on Yahoo that I was trying to make a racial statement inside the White House.
Okay. Yeah.
You followed my stuff for years. Yeah. You know, like that's just not my bag at all. Yeah. And so then my Persian mother-in-law gets an email from her cousin saying, wait, isn't that like Shauna's husband? I didn't know that he was this thing. That kind of stuff to this day infuriates me, actually.
Yeah,
because you're messing with the person's family. Sure. You're lying about them. It's one thing to be like, well, Cernovitz said this thing, and even though he was joking, let's all pretend he's not joking. It's like, okay, but at least I said it. Mm-hmm. At least you have some integrity there.
Yeah.
But when they do things like that, you'll never become comfortable with that. You'll never just accept
that
somebody's lying to you and you're the number one story in the world about a lie. That you remember that stuff for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's I think that is the worst. Cause I mean that's borderline, I mean, maybe not even borderline, you know, becomes sort of libel or slander
in UK, when
someone
is
saying, someone is literally saying, okay, like you did this or you said, and it's like, no, like I really didn't. If it's like, okay, I said this thing and you misinterpreted it or whatever, that's one thing. But I mean, it's weird. Like I try not to, especially now. I mean, I used to be able to sort of like happily Google myself or like search for myself on certain things and not be, you know, I'd be excited about people writing about me. Whereas now, I mean, I don't even know what it would be like for you, where it's just like, I don't know. I'm still trying to work out that balance between not being sort of totally detached and just because I don't want to ignore, like, I mean, you know, most people who know me do like me, and I don't want to, you know, ignore my actual fans or my supporters and not respond to them or anything. But it's like, in order to do that, sometimes it's like you have to wade through the sewage to find the nuggets of gold.
Yeah, well, and most of it, and that's the problem too, is you have to come to terms with most people who don't like you, they just like you. They buy your stuff. You know, like my movie Hoax was at like number 3 on documentaries on iTunes. Like, but all those people doing it aren't gonna be like, I like you. Yeah, when you hate someone, you want to let that person know, I hate your guts. So you feel like, oh my God, the world hates me. Yeah. There's like a couple people who like me. And it's actually the opposite. 100 for every one hater, 100 people like you. But they're not going to tell you. So once you just attune that, you like me, I'm just a block machine. I'm like, oh God, block. block you.
Yeah.
And you get over it, and you do have to, it's part of the artistic revival. It keeps you fresh. It keeps you lucid, to have that kind of resistance and to have that going on. It's just, oh my God, it's like a nagging ex-wife. Like, just leave me alone. I don't care. You're not hurting my feelings. Yeah. I'm not sad. I'm not mad. It's just like Viagra spam email or something. Like, oh, I got to go through my email every day and delete like 50 emails.
Yeah.
I got to block 50 people a day. Ugh.
Yeah. I just find it weird how much people go out of their way. Like that's the thing I find odd. I mean, I have some people who are, I don't know, they'll subscribe to my YouTube channel or they'll follow me on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever. Like just to, I mean, it's a little bit like, it's like, you know how every time Trump tweets, like there's like the same sort of 10 accounts that respond to every single tweet without fail. It's like, okay, if I look at this tweet, this person, yep, there they are. And I find that it's weird because especially as a musician, it's like, it's almost like it's the other side of like a super fan.
Yeah, Howard Stern showed that where the radio, the hate listeners would listen to something like 75% more than right. No, he because he was the original guy who was hated, right? And yeah. To us, that's funny. You're like, wait, people hate Howard Stern? How could you? Oh, he was despised the level that we're not even like close to.
Yeah.
And they went through and they actually did the data. The hate listeners listen to your stuff more than people because people like you, like, oh, yeah, I like Mike. I like Zuby. I'll listen to that in a week or so. Yeah. The haters are like, oh, God, I wonder if they said anything that I can clip out. Hell yeah. Like, let's do this.
Yeah, it is. It's such a strange mentality because I just don't have that at all in me. Firstly, I don't hate anybody. I can honestly say that I do not hate anyone, right? You know, right. There's people I disagree with. There might be some people who I don't like or, you know, I don't like the way they come across or something, but there's literally no person in this world who I hate. And even if I don't like somebody's content or I don't like the last thing I'm going to do is follow them and listen to absolutely everything and comment and engage with everything. Like that's just such a, I don't know. We've only got so many hours in the day and it just strikes me as a very bizarre way for someone to spend their time or to dedicate.
Yeah, I've had haters find things that I'm like, I don't even know what this is. There's like all these audios of me. And I'm like, yeah. I don't even think this is me. And then I would go back and I'm like, I don't remember it. And there was one because it sounded pretty bad. I was like, what is this? You know, yeah. I don't. And then I found out it was like, do an impersonation of Charles Manson. So then I was I am a serial, you know, like I'm just saying all these things. But I'm like, this was in 2012. I don't even remember saying that, let alone doing it. So then you have to actually, because people be like, well, what is that? And because usually I don't care. I'm like, oh my God. But I'm like, no, that actually sounds pretty bad. Let me find out what was going on there.
Yeah.
I'm like, where? And then I'm talking to Shauna. I'm like, she's like, I don't know. I don't even know where this is from. So that's how dedicated your haters are. They're finding things that you don't even know that you did.
Yeah.
And then you don't even remember when it was. And then you have to find out when it was. And then you have to go back and listen and waste your time. And then you're like, oh, of course. So now when people ask me, I'm just like, look, it's a deep fake. Everything is just a deep fake.
It's a deep fake.
I'm so tired of telling people like, right now, like if we do a podcast and I were to say like certain words, I would spell them out. Mm-hmm. Like I'm a 42-year-old man, but I know that if I say it, that'll get clipped out. With, you know, the part where I'm saying I'm about to do an impersonation.
Yeah, yeah.
So, or if I do video and I'm saying things, I'll cover my mouth a little bit. That way it just messes up the video of it. Mm. And I'm laughing because this is absurd. This is an absurd world that we live in, especially now with coronavirus hitting. And you're realizing all that time, all those people spent drudging stuff up is nothing. It means talk about building your house on sand. It means nothing. We have a real crisis and suddenly those people are worried about other things, but they should have been worried about those other things before.
Yeah. So big question. I mean, what made you want to step into the political arena?
I didn't. I mean, you remember my old writing. I was anti-politics.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's why I'm curious as to how did you end up becoming, you know, seen that way?
Truly accidental.
Okay.
And I was in, so the story goes, I was just in Paris walking around, you know, living the dream life. And I saw these like newspaper covers, Le Monde or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was just orange hair. And it looked like this yellow blazing kiosk because it was Trump's face everywhere. And I go, oh yeah, Donald Trump's on for president. Yeah, he's probably going to win the nomination.
Okay.
So I just tweeted, oh yeah, Trump's gonna like clearly. At the time, early on, I thought Ted Cruz still would have got him because Ted Cruz is so smart. Mm-hmm. You know, Ted Cruz is like Elon Musk. He's not the best guy to bet against. So I was like, oh yeah, I think Trump will. People are like yelling at me, no, he won't. 3% ceiling. I was like, no, he just, what I know about human nature is that's not how it works. If everybody in the world knows about you, more than three people are going to like you, right? Mm-hmm. Just the numbers don't work. So I started arguing with people. And then I was like, I'll show you. I'm going to help this guy. Okay. So there's no like noble origin story where I fall in Damascus and I fall down and I see the light.
Okay. Wow. And then, I mean, cause that really was like a big part of your gig for a while, wasn't it? You know, you did kind of become the Trump guy, you know?
I mean, we would make every hashtag in 2015 and 16 trend. News stories had to like report on us. I have a full profile in the New Yorker, which I've been profiled in the New York Times. Like every it's so bizarre. Like to say, you're just like, yeah, it really is what put me on the map politically, so to speak, even though my life was better just on an objective level when all I did was the mindset stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just so much like low stress. Nobody's trying. Like, you would get a random stalker now and then, but not like I have now. And I was like, literally my life was, I'd wake up and so I finished the book in Vietnam.
Okay.
And then I went to Koh Samui. So I just hit publish, self-publish, why I'm at a resort in Koh Samui, swimming in the water and everything with, you know, a beautiful woman. And
in hindsight now, given where things are now, do you have any, are you sort of happy that you went in that direction, or are you a little bit apprehensive? If you could go back, would you have done stuff differently at all?
Yeah, I don't know that I ever would have gotten to this world. Looking back, it, you know, in a way we've done some significant things. I think we've moved the world in a better place. I think we prevented a major war in Syria. So, but that takes a toll on you. That's for sure. So my earlier life was much more, it was an easy life. Yeah. It was a good life. It was a fun life. There's almost a lesson in, you know, your own journey as a man where you're not really a man until other people rely on you. Because people say, what's a man, right? You're a man when other people rely on you. And before I got into politics, nobody ever relied on me.
Okay.
Like, you know, I had Shauna and whatever, but, you know, she was young, attractive, has her own money. You know, it's not really the obligation. Yeah. Now it's like the weight of the world. The weight of the world is on me in a way that it wasn't before. So that's why I don't have a yes or no answer.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not a yes or no answer.
I mean, what were the biggest changes for you in terms of sort of, I don't know, like real life or, you know, what massively changed for you in that regard?
Right. Workload increased, pay decreased. Mm-hmm. So you would think that because I'm, you know, quote unquote more notable now that I would be making more money, but it's actually the opposite.
Okay.
If you just have like a niche that you're in, that you just kill it, that's a very, very good place to be. People underestimate that. And the pressures, you know, like I literally talk to people in the White House every day.
Okay.
You know, things that we talk about, like with coronavirus, you can watch them filter up through like me on Twitter to World Affairs. So there's always these pictures of presidents how they ages them. And you can look at me 4 years ago and then today.
Yeah.
That's what I've really done is the weightiness of it. The world becomes quite weighty when you're involved in anything political, because in terms of the media attacks and everything, to be honest, bro, I mean, and you'll appreciate this. Maybe a lot of people wouldn't believe it, but it's true. The ride was so fun. I don't care. Like, oh, you insulted me. Like, dude, literally people, you couldn't pay for a New Yorker profile. You couldn't pay for front page of the New York Times. Like, I've been everywhere. I've got to see media up close. I've got to know how everything is really done, how the world, the greatest backstage pass and the most significant events in our lifetimes I've been privy to. That's just an amazing, and that's also too, the political people don't understand that they hate that answer. Political people want me to be like, I was Paul. I was on my camel or my donkey or whatever. I fell down. I saw God and I decided I had to sacrifice myself. Me, it's just like the ride, bro, has been absurd and so fascinating. Like there's literally a book out about my life, like all this weird stuff that doesn't lead to any money for me or even fame because my people don't even read it.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you just think in terms of have you lived an interesting life, are you going to ever look back and say, did I kill it? Did I really kill it? Did I really do what I could possibly do? I probably would have felt that way.
Yeah.
If I had just stayed in the area that I was.
I gotcha. You just said something there that actually interested me. You said my people. So when you say my people now, I mean, what does that mean? Because you've been in so many different worlds now. Someone like myself, like I can't remember when I first heard about you, but I want to say maybe 6 or so years ago, roughly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've kind of seen this journey and development, you know, I know probably, I don't know the split, but I'd imagine the majority of people who have heard about you now know about you more from like the Trump and post-Trump stuff. And then there are people who are kind of on board earlier. A bit like me, right? There's a huge percentage of my audience has never heard my music now, which is kind of like strange because everything used to just be about the music. So who is your audience? What kind of person resonates with you? Because one thing that's really funny with your account, especially on Twitter, is, you know, I know you, of course, you're super aware of this, but I find it funny as someone who's followed you for a while is that people always want to put you in a very certain and tight box, right? And I know you like to intentionally jump out of that box, right? Say something that you know is really gonna, like, you know, be inflammatory, in fact, sometimes towards people who expect you to kind of go down this certain line. And so what kind of person do you observe being sort of your audience or your tribe? Like what's the thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm speaking of which, like, yeah, I lost 10,000 Twitter followers because I was like, I'm going to help Democrats win the Senate. Come on. I'm going to be knocking doors. Get out of here, right? So those people are not my audience.
Okay.
And I try to make that like very – I even said something about Sharia law one time or Muslims. It's just
– I saw like,
if you don't like Muslims or you're afraid of Sharia law in every corner, you are not my audience. My family's Christian. My family's Muslim.
Yeah.
Just – They coexist in Jordan, like they coexist in Israel. So I will provoke a little bit just to say, look, I don't want you here. And by that, I mean just the low consciousness, angry, bitter people. Mm. My people, my tribe is always going to be edgier people.
Yeah.
And we have, if I had to describe it demographically, it's men 25 to 44, and then a ton of like women, because I'm like a wayward son. So I feel like there's all these women, right? So if you're they're more like, well, you know, that's just, you know, boys, that's how they act sometimes. And so they're always defending me, these like grandmas and moms. Oh, we love certain, just the way these, you know, they act sometimes. Yeah. So I have that like split. And that's why people who come over, and a ton of reporters, by the way.
Yeah.
That's one of like the biggest secrets about me is the reporters. But the idea though is like, you imagine you come on Twitter and you think, oh, here's this political guy and he's got kids and you insult me and I'm like making fun of your hairline or telling you fat or something, right? That was yesterday.
Yeah.
So people, that part of me, you know, for a while I toned it down and I was, I just didn't feel good anymore. I didn't feel authentic about what I was doing. Yeah, yeah. I was attracting a lot of people like who shouldn't be reading me anymore. So I always want to have the group of people who, let's just body slam some people. But I prefer to keep a positive, but if you want to come over and, you know, poke and prod me or something that.
That's exactly how I feel. You know, I get, people don't know what it's like to have a big account. Like it totally changes the dynamics of everything. It's really weird with me because my thoughts and views have changed not that much in the past 15 years, right? But there's stuff like I could have said this 3 years ago and, you know, nobody nobody cares, or it's just, it's not a big thing. Like, I'm just saying the same stuff that I say with my friends or my parents or whatever in private. Right. And then, you know, I say, I'll say something on Twitter. I mean, just the other day, you know, I was probably still going on. I don't check it on Sundays, but, you know, I've had like thousands of people trying to shellack me for saying something positive about Saudi Arabia recently. Right. Because, you know, I lived in a country for 20 years and I've just done a podcast with someone from there and I've just brought up like a couple of things. And suddenly it's just, you know, all these people who claim to be open-minded and claim to be tolerant and what, it just flips completely. And it's just like, oh, wow. You know, it's like, oh, Zuby's not who, he, you know, he's not who he thought he was.
You changed, man.
And I'm just like, if you asked me what I thought of Saudi Arabia when I was 12, I would have given you the exact, you know, I probably wouldn't have articulated it quite as well, but I'm trying to offer different perspectives here, right? Like, this is my background. This is what I know. You know, here's something to think about. Whether you agree, disagree, whatever, you know, like, here, have a think about this, right? Have a think about that. But it's like, and I think, you know, a lot of people get it. I do think the majority do understand that. But it's just weird sort of leading back into what we were saying before about, you know, the misinterpretations and the labels and just the things. And you're just like, sometimes, you know, you kind of want to get in there and you've got the energy and you want to respond to everybody. And then sometimes you're just like, you know what, if you don't get it, then maybe I can't make you get it.
Yeah. There's a lot of issues at play. Number one is that if you went into a room and said, oh God, stupid people are terrible, everybody would agree with you. Yeah. It's like, well, half of you are stupid though. Just by definitely. But if you said to people, yeah, we're the free thinkers. If you said that in any room, everybody'd be like, hell yeah. It's the other people that aren't free thinkers. But you say one little thing like that. That was me with some of my, this was in 2017, my own event. I got shouted down by people because in an audience Q&A, I was like, oh yeah, you know, moderate Islam is fine. And you know, I know they're like, there's no such thing as moderate Islam. Oh, gosh. I'm like, people just paid a lot of money to see me talk. And you're like, there. And so I'm like, wait, these are my people. Okay. I need to make something very clear. So even if I overstate things,
they're
the idea. And a lot of people who are smarter, so like the infamous Islam tweet, for example, what the smart people realized is I showed how in parts, and I don't want to politicize your podcast too much, but whatever you think about Drag Queen Story Hour, the Muslims just said, we're not going to do it.
No.
We're just not going to do it.
No.
And you know what? They didn't do it. And you know what? It's gone.
Yeah.
So the message that I was saying to Christians was, if all of you, it's like, you can't, there's a saying in protests, you can't arrest everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you can't fire every Christian. There are 80 million Christians in the US, you know, 20 million in the UK or however many. If everybody went to one of those school things and just said, you're not going to do it, we're going to take all our kids off, all of us, collectively, guess what? It goes away.
Of course, yeah.
So the people who actually had a little bit of nuance are like, oh, okay, maybe I was being inflammatory. But the answer to that is, like, of course I was being inflammatory. That's how you get people to – this is the problem is if you – not the problem, but the problem the readers have is that if you want to make a point, if I just said Twitter thread incoming – political action happens when everybody unites and there's something known as a collective action problem. If I just said Muslims are going to win, realize the future. And then they're like, he hates Christians now and everything.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, like, there's truth in stuff. Again, I lived in Saudi. The Saudi thing was so weird because 99.9% of the people commenting have never been there. Know very, very, very little about the country, about the people, about the culture, about anything. Most of the people who actually are from Saudi who are responding are agreeing with me and saying positive things, including Saudi women who are DMing me saying, oh, thanks for like not misrepresenting my country. Thanks for like being fair to us and whatever. I've got some who want to come on my podcast now because I keep getting, oh, well, you wouldn't be saying that if you were a woman and you've never spoken to a Saudi. And but you know, as someone who's grown up in different places and has, you know, we've both traveled a lot, we've seen different places and everything. And it gives you a perspective where you can see, you can kind of see the pros and cons and the strengths and the weaknesses of all different things. Okay. I'm a Christian, but there are things I can see in Islam that, and the way that Muslims you know, do certain things, which certainly in the, like the modern Western world, right? The drag queen story hour thing is actually a great example, right? They're stronger in certain aspects, drawing a line in the sand or like putting their foot down or whatever. Does it mean I support like everything there 100%? No, it doesn't. But at the same time, I'm like, hey, you know, there are certain things we in the West could learn from that culture or that society or that country, or you know what, like, oh, they look at this, look at the way they do that there, right? But you know, people are so into the West is the best mentality, and they don't want to question or challenge anything in that regard. And it sort of blinds people. And I'm not like, you know, where people say, oh, I'm shilling for Saudi Arabia, I'm anti-Western now. Like 3 days ago, I suddenly became anti-Western. It's like, no, I'm not saying any of this, but it's just such a binary, people's thinking is so binary. And I don't always understand that.
Yeah, even with the Muslim thing, is I try to tell people, they're okay with you being Christian. It's like a radical sect. And they're like, well, the moderate Muslims turn their other, everybody does in every culture. This has actually been demonstrated. That's the problem of human nature, is that radicals tend to win because they're so extreme until there's massive culture. That was even shown with the leftists. Most liberals don't want you to lose your job over a tweet. They just don't. But they don't want to draw the fire of these like psychotic social justice warriors either. So they like turn the other way.
Yeah.
So if you want to say, well, I can't believe that, you know, moderate Muslims, you know, look the other way. It's like, well, they don't want to get killed by the terrorists too. That's what like drives me insane. I'm like, don't you understand that the greatest number of people who are killed by jihadis are Muslims? Mm-hmm. That's the number one group being killed. And this is just a factor. Then they're like, well, you know, what about Christians? I'm like, there are Christians actually in parts of the world where they burn, you know, people for witchcraft. Like, there's just cultures that haven't fully percolated to, and Christians, by the way, were burning people as heretics a few hundred years ago. When you, and this, that's where traveling and reading widely goes, is when you've read a lot of history and read a lot of accounts of early religions, you realize, you know, we see now that some cultures and countries are like 500 years ahead of other people. Mm-hmm. But the idea is, why don't we bring those other people, you know, a little bit up with us rather than hate them or demonize? Saudi Arabia is a great example. Is, mm-hmm. you know, most people in Saudi Arabia, like, they're just driving cars to work. Yeah. You only see the sheiks and the obscene wealth or whatever. And most Saudi Arabias are working in oil fields like people in Texas, or they're working mm-hmm. adjacent to oil fields. And people who, friends of mine who've gone to Harvard MBAs, they go to Saudi Arabia is quite an educated country. Yeah. They're like, yeah, you can't get anything past these people because Saudi Arabia, they're sending their, you know, all their people to be educated in Western countries. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever talks about that. Now, the flip side is when Saudi commits a crime in the U.S., mm-hmm. there's been cases where they've helped those people get back in Saudi Arabia. So you can have, and by the way, when you talk to Saudis about that, they're like, yeah, we don't really agree with that either.
Yeah, just like I don't think most Americans agree with every action of the American government.
Yeah, the drone strikes, right? Imagine that. Like, well, Americans are evil. Why?
Yeah.
They bombed a wedding.
Yeah.
I oppose it. What am I supposed to do?
Dude, this has been, you know, I don't want to focus on this one issue so much, but it's like, that's sort of, it's just a great example of this weird thing that happens online and just sort of in people's brains, where what I noticed, especially in this conversation, was you had people comparing the best of one country or culture with the worst of another country or culture, right? If I wanted to focus on the bad things in America, right? Like, because I kind of posted about this legitimately before I went to the US last year, I had people, like friends from the UK who haven't been to America before, and they were like, you shouldn't go. You know, I had people saying, oh, you know, like the racism against black people or police brutality, you know, make sure you don't get shot by the police. I had people saying, you know, be careful. Like there's, you know, all these mass shooters and, you know, there's so many guns and it's really, really dangerous. I had people saying, you know, you shouldn't go while Trump is in office because, you know, he's amped up the white supremacists and, you know, you might not be safe. And, you know, people were saying this like genuinely. And so, you know, as me, I'm like, guys, I get the same if I travel to Poland or Estonia or whatever, and people are there like, you know, be aware of the racism. They're going to, you know, and I've been to all these places. Everything's fine. People are nice and all that. And, you know, I'm trying to tell people the same thing with Saudi, because people are like, oh, well, what about, you know, Jamal Khashoggi? Or what about, you know, they'll pick out this incident that happened 5 years ago or this thing about a public execution or whatever. And I'm like, look, you're focusing on this would be like me just talking about the US. And yeah, I'm talking about like mass shooters, and I'm talking about school shootings, and I'm talking about, you know, drone strikes, and I'm talking about like all the worst stuff that goes on in the US, the opioid crisis and homelessness and all that. But if someone were to ask you like to describe American culture, I don't think you'd be like, yeah, we've got a huge opioid epidemic, and, you know, people are living on the street in California, and we have mass shooters, and people like go to Walmart with guns. It's like, that's not kind of the everyday life thing. And I just think people are really, I don't know. People call me biased and say, okay, Zuby's being biased. He's shilling for Saudi Arabia. He loves Saudi Arabia, whatever. And I'm like, look, man, I'm trying to open your mind to at least consider this thing. I don't know.
It's that way with everything. I remember when I would start traveling, people be like, oh, you're gonna go to Thailand. Are you like afraid of Thailand? And I'm like, that's the safest country that I've ever been in. Vietnam is a communist country. Yeah. Safest country. You go to an ATM, there's just no crime. Now, the flip side is there's no crime, because if you're a criminal, they'll just like beat you up in the streets.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that's a good thing either, but I'm just saying, it's complicated. That's why whenever people go, what do you think about? Well, it's complicated. South Africa, for example, if you read certain parts of the internet,
oh yeah,
you think, well, you're going to go to South Africa, there's this blood in the streets. Well, no, there's a lot of crime. It's largely in shanty towns, mm-hmm. or I don't know what the PC think for that now is, but you can go to, you know, Lion's Head Mountain and hike and everything else. So even in a place where there's objectively a lot of violence.
Sure.
There's not just like blood in the streets. It's actually quite a wonderful place. And mm-hmm. it's like any city, same way in Chicago, DC, people like, I remember, cause I grew up in it all goes down to periorcalism, where I'm a localist, but I have a global perspective. Mm-hmm. So I remember I grew up in a small town, and I was always so afraid to go to Chicago. It's like, oh my God, you get mugged. Cause that's what you in your own mind. But then what would happen is I would know people from the city who are afraid of the country.
Okay.
They think everything's Deliverance. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, but there's like an infamous scene in it, and we can talk about that after the podcast over. But they think they're afraid to go to the South. They're like, oh my God, you take one wrong turn, you're in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Right? So everybody, no matter where you're from, there's always that kind of fear of the unknown. Where once you've been around, you're like, yeah, I mean, there are some podunk places. Like one time, because I grew up in such places, I was driving with a girl I was dating at the time. I forget the name of the place, but we pulled in and there was like a sheriff at a gas station, some like really 500-pound guy who looked just off kilter, and they all just stopped and looked at us. And I said, let's get out of here. Yeah. You know, that was a vibe. It probably would have been okay. They didn't have the credit cards at the thing. So it was like a scene out of the movie. Yeah. And I was like, okay, we're out of here, dude. We need to get out of here fast, and like watching us leave. So I don't even know how we ended up there. So there is, but that's not most of the South. That's not most of Texas. That's not most of rural areas, but city people are like death. If you grew up in the city in America, you're deathly afraid of the country. And same thing, if you go in the country, you're afraid of the city. Same thing if you grew up with you. So that's where even just traveling, reading older books, realizing that everything is far more nuanced and far more complicated than we could ever imagine, and hold off a little bit. That's why I always tell people, it's like, yeah, that hold off a little bit, to just chill a little bit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you have to accept the bad aspects of it, but then, but again, back to Saudi, why it's so funny is most of the Saudis you're going to talk to online are Western educated Saudis, mm-hmm. and they're going to agree with you when you criticize the Saudi government. You're like, we hate Saudi Arabia because of this. And you're like, well, I mean, have you talked to these people? They're like, they have, you know, they kind of feel the same way. And there's actually MBS feels the same way too, and he's trying to change, but you don't just change a culture with the flip of the switch, right?
No,
there's
no.
All these power bases and everything. And
of course. And one thing I noticed in that as well is like, people forget how long certain things took to achieve in the West. Right. So people are talking about the UK or the USA as if everything all throughout forever has been totally fine. And no one's been discriminated against, and everyone's been treated kindly and fair. I'm like, come on, guys. Like, I'm not one of these far lefty types who's like wants to, you know, crap on Western imperialism or, you know, racism or, you know, all that stuff. I'm not trying to like dwell on this stuff forever, but it's like, come on, man. Like US alone, like how many years was there? It's slavery for centuries, like around the globe, around the world, thousands of years. people act like gay marriage was always legal and this was always there. I'm like, come on, man. Like, you can go back just 10 years ago, even just go back like 15 years ago. And a lot of the stuff you're saying, you know, the situation was a little bit different, let alone if you go back 50 years ago. And it's like, that's only one person. You know, that's like one, that's not even one person's lifetime. So if you want stuff to change, you have to like give people, you have to give people in places some time, right? Saudi Arabia is not, it's like the West does something and then they just want to like snap their fingers and expect the rest of the world, like all the countries in Africa, all the countries in Asia, all the Islamic countries, like, oh, they should just do exactly what we just did. And I'm like, right. Okay, but it took you like how many hundred years to make that decision? And
right.
Why don't you give them some time to work out, well, if one, if they want to make that decision, and then two, if they do, you know, give some time for the people to, you know, for it to happen. Like, these things do take a while.
Yeah, they take a while, and then sometimes they go too fast. Mm-hmm. And then now you're like, wait, how did like we get here where there's like the example that I always use, and I won't use the name because I, you know, still a child, even as a public figure, is like if you and I and a couple guys were sitting around a table and an 11-year-old girl like jumped up and started dancing and somebody threw dollars at it, yeah. Like we would get killed. You know, it just, I mean, literally, no, yeah. I mean, you're not walk out of there.
Yeah.
But then if it's a quote unquote drag queen kid,
oh, gosh,
doing that, you're the bad person if you don't like celebrate it. And yeah. Me, I'm like, I've always been Mr. Libertarian, even to the point of like libertine, like be a, if you're an adult, whatever you're doing with other adults, good for you. The more, the merrier, the more fun. But I'm sitting here like, okay, maybe I was just wrong. Okay. Yeah. The Christian conservatives were right. I was just wrong.
The slippery slope arguments don't sound so silly now, do you?
Yeah, because I've watched everything that was, well, that'll never happen. I'm like, I mean, it's happening. And now they're trying to normalize pedophilia.
Literally.
And that's to the scary. Point where Twitter's terms of service allows you to talk about
it's trippy.
As a sexuality. But if you tried to talk about racism as an ideology, you'd get banned.
It's trippy.
So it's like, yeah, I'm like, okay. So a lot of the Christian conservatives I mocked in my younger days. So then you start to see a little bit of moderate Islam coming in. You're like, well, you know, yeah, let's have a talk with these people. You know, let's
balance.
Form an alliance. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a balance, you know. Yes, it is possible to be too conservative, but it's also possible to be too liberal. Like, I think the West is kind of forgotten that. I mean, I do hope this, I don't know if it'll happen. Hopefully this coronavirus situation might sort of reset people's perceptions at least a little bit, you know, because I think people have been too soft and comfortable for too long. I think it's, you know, in a weird way, in a silver lining kind of way, I think it's good to have some sort of, you know, a bigger issue at hand to sort of get away from some of the nonsense.
And the people, and that's an interesting disconnect too, especially with the media writ large, is I noticed the big people, and this happened in America after 9/11, people have come together. The media in the US anyway, they're the only group that their ratings, not their ratings, rather, their the perception of them's declined. Because I am seeing just a lot of Orange Man bad, get Trump. He didn't know this soon enough. And then you go and read the people's Twitter accounts, and they were the ones saying it wasn't a big threat. And you're like, okay, this is just not honest. So I think what'll happen post-corona is if you're just like a normal person, at least for a month or two, you know, maybe longer, hopefully, you're just like, I don't care. This is so petty. Yeah. That's what I read this beautiful post by an Italian writer who's caught up in quarantine and what it's like to live under quarantine. Mm. And one thing he said is all of these grievances you had with people felt very significant.
Yes.
Until you can't leave your house. You can't even see your own children because everyone's under quarantine. People are dying, overwhelming the hospital system. And you start to think, yeah, well, why did I even not like that person? Why was I even caught up in this like trifling thing? What was even going on? Unfortunately, one of the curses of us as human beings is we'll be right back into that nonsense.
It'll come back, yeah. It'll come back. And one, you know, I'm coming. We're running up on 1 hour. One big question I did want to ask you, as someone who's you know, been following your work for a while and seen you go through these different stages, is how has, you know, getting married and becoming a father sort of changed your view and outlook on everything?
Well, on a personal level, I do start to think about like Google results. My daughter's old enough to Google. So I'm like, okay, my motto for the past 3 years has been, don't give them anything new.
Okay.
So there's not there, you know, even there, so there's nothing new on me. If you want to hate me, you're hating me for 10 years old stuff, 15 years old stuff, and that's fine. See, I'm very much like, well, okay, you know, we don't need to go here, we don't need to go there. But it has given me just a lot of empathy. So financially, it's not like I'm some rich guy or whatever, but you know, I've done okay. Mm-hmm. And when I go to the store now, I'm like, things are expensive. How are people making it? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand the math of just how people are even paying their bills. So politically, it's just made me really more passionate to try to just help people who they're one paycheck away from doom, really. Like, how can we make the world better for people? Like, you're not trying to buy a Lamborghini. You're not trying to live in a mansion. All you're trying to do is live like a decent life with your kids and be able to take care of them. And you can't even do that.
Yeah.
So it's made me just empathetic in a way that I never was before. Hence all the gray hair.
Yeah. I feel all that. No, because as an outside observer and, you know, more of a friend, I have noticed that, you know, it does seem to have mellowed you out in a lot of ways and, you know, maybe shifted the perspective on certain things. Like, I'm not married and I'm not a dad yet, but I'm always interested in men I know, whether that's like my own brothers or certain friends who have kind of, I've seen go through those stages. And as someone who's like very observant, I'm always just interested to kind of observe and, you know, kind of see how different people do things and how it affects them and everything like that. So
The biggest thing is, you think more globally in your choices. Mm-hmm. Where before, I just would do it YOLO. I don't care, man.
Yeah.
And now you're like, well, my kid would grow up without a dad. What would that be like for her?
we don't want that happening, man. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Mike. We'll definitely get you again on in the future. It won't be the only one. So
No, it's a pleasure. I love to see guys like you come out from, you know, doing mixtapes to, you know, like, you got a real presence, man. It's a really beautiful thing what you've done and what you've accomplished. I'm very happy for you.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate it, man. Is there, before we go, is there anything that you've got coming up or you've got out that you want people to check out?
Well, I didn't plug my movie, which, you know, that shows how intimate our friendship is, that I'm usually notorious for shilling things at any time I can. Okay. So yeah, I do have a hoax movie, which we had a limited release on Vimeo only a year ago, but now it's like widely released, Amazon, iTunes, Hulu, every streaming platform.
Awesome.
The ratings are great. You've watched it. You've said nice things about it. So
yeah, it's good.
Yeah, people haven't heard of Hoaxed, watch that. Because also too, Hoax explains a lot of why I used to do what I would do.
Gotcha. Awesome. Mike Cernovich, thank you so much for joining the podcast, man. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. See you next time.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obane, click and I bang.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.